Irreverent. Entertaining. Cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and with me is my co-host, Dr. Matt Polacek. And you know, it's been a few weeks since we've been in studio together, but we're back, and I'm certainly excited and looking forward to doing this show.
It is great to see you, Alan, and I'm also really excited to be back together on Answers for the Family. And for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
And please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases, entertain.
While bringing answers and options to making your lives happier, healthier, and more successful.
Now, this show will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more.
We'll introduce you to talented authors and new innovations in the areas of health, security, and fun for you and your family.
Now, with our experience working with families in crisis, we've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us.
You know, Alan, we have both been around a while and we've seen a lot of things. And one thing that really fascinates me with the way the world is evolving is that there's things that are positive and negative. I was this weekend at a friend's house, and his little boy had a really serious peanut allergy. And to me, it's fascinating how much more prevalent peanut allergies are today than in the past. And when stuff like that happens, it makes me really curious about really what's going on. What's the role of nature, diet, culture, and other things that play a role in these, you know, fascinating social constructs? Another incredible and unfortunate increase we've seen in adolescence is this rise in autism. In fact, since 2006, autism is the leading disorder affecting children in the United States.
You know, Matt, and it's something that we've seen as well. Doing the transports, we have learned that there are more and more cases that we are contracting with school districts and we are taking them to specialized program far more over about the last 4 or 5 years than any time before.
Wow.
Now, luckily for us, that we're going to be able to explore this topic in much more depth, because today our guest is Dr. Jerry Cartsonell, who is a board-certified pediatrician and a fellow in the American Academy of Pediatrics, whose specialty includes diagnosing and treating autism in children. The doctor is a nationally recognized speaker and a New York Times best-selling author. His medical interventions have improved the lives of his patients who suffer from many types of medical conditions that include autism, allergies, sleep cycle disruptions, and hormonal imbalances. He regularly teaches continuing education seminars and courses on children's health issues to physicians and to other health professionals.
His focus became even clearer when he had a personal connection with autism, which we will definitely talk about later. But this led him to co-writing a book, Healing and Preventing Autism, which I'm really looking forward to discussing with you and him today.
Well, we don't have our guest as of yet, but we know that he will be calling in. We've spoken to his staff, and so we should be hearing from him shortly. So I've been gone for about 10 days, Matt. What's been going on around here?
Things are really well. You know, we were lucky to have Joelle come in last week and touch on a very important topic with adolescence. And to me, today's topic, it's really fascinating. And a lot of the questions that go through my head really with this rise in autism, is it that we're more educated on autism? Do we know how to, you know, kind of screen for the signs more? Or is there, like peanut allergies, just a huge natural increase? And if there is, what's going on here?
Right. And you used the word natural, and I'm more concerned with if we're having an unnatural reason in regards to the increase. What's your thoughts on that?
You know, it's fascinating, and we see we're so fortunate with the research now and being able to look at, you know, brain scans and being able to understand health, and then also have a, you know, a clear understanding of what we do as people to contribute, whether it be you know, air pollution and other natural causes, but also, you know, what's our role as a society? Are we, you know, are we poisoning our future, or is it is this just something that was bound to happen? You know, I'm not really sure, but hopefully today we'll get a little more answers.
Well, and in trying to learn a little bit more about this subject, and I looked up a few things, and I noticed that one of the areas that came up multiple times was diet. And we'll be able to ask our guest that because we have him calling in right now. Hi, this is Alan Cardoza and Dr. Matt Polacek. You're on Answers for the Family. Okay, I thought that we had it.
You know, thinking of it as you reconnect us, I was always so, not adamantly against or frustrated with, but I really didn't realize the impact of diet on our behavior, on our thoughts, on our ability to function. And a few, maybe a month ago, we had the author of Sugar Crush on, and sitting and listening to him discuss the influence of sugars and the influence on diet on human behavior was really fascinating to me. And when you think of a disorder such as autism, you would think, you know, logically, how much of an impact that would have. And so it's going to be really interesting to see what Dr. Cardoza has to say about that, because I know he really emphasized that in his most recent book.
Now, in your situation, I mean, you know, being at Betty Ford and dealing with Hazleton, what is the... is this something that you're seeing more of there? Is it something that, that we're having, you know, more people being diagnosed? And the other question I have is that in regards to Asperger's, it's my understanding that now they've sort of discontinued using that term and tied it all into autism. What's the basis on that?
Yeah, you know, the new DSM, which was released a little earlier this year, basically, instead of...
Hi, this is Alan Cardoza and Dr. Matt Polacek.
Hi, this is Jerry Cardsonell.
All right.
Hello, Jerry. Glad to have you.
Good to be here.
Good. We were just asking ourselves some of the questions that we're looking forward to getting answers from you from.
We got our expert now. So one thing Al and I were discussing really is this alarming rate of the rise in autism, and we specifically were looking at diet. And I know that, you know, your background and a lot of your studies and research is in the area of diet and the connection to autism.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. So when we talk about two things here, an alarming rate of children with autism, we have to understand that autism is still a catchphrase, basically describing children who are not responding to stimuli in a normal fashion. So there's the spectrum of diseases, which is kind of interesting in that in my clinic, I'll have children who come in and say, they'll come in, they'll sit in the corner and bite their wrist and rock, have a finger in the ear, and they don't understand mom saying, I love you, or dad saying, go get your shoes. They don't understand that their bladder is full and they have to go tinkle, or if they step on something sharp, it hurts. In other words, all these stimuli coming from outside their environment, like mom saying something, or internally, like I'm hungry or I gotta go pee-pee, none of that makes sense to them. So all stimuli has no real value for them. On the other hand, you can have children who are doing remarkably well. They're in school, they've got friends, they play on a soccer team, but when the teachers say, talking about George Washington being the first president of the United States, married a wonderful lady named Martha, was in the Revolutionary War, when that stimuli comes in auditorily, they don't process it well. So next week when they're asked who was the first president of the United States, they don't have a clue. And all other stimuli they do pretty well with. So somewhere between those two kids are our children. So now you ask the question about diet. And you ask the question, what role do certain foods play in their ability to understand stimuli better. In other words, for example, sleep. When I have kids who go gluten-free and dairy-free, they're now able to sleep like everybody else's kid at nighttime. Wow. Or be able to have normal bowel movements.
Now, now you're talking in regards to diet. Are there some other things that are now being found to be contributors to this increase in autism?
There's a lot of theories out there, and that's always really disappointing for me. We've got, like you'd mentioned, all these children who do have the diagnosis of autism, but there's very little work being done at any of our major medical schools to try to elucidate why they have autism, what happened. So, you know, there's everything from GMO foods to pesticides, cell phones, of course, the vaccine controversy. There's a lot of things out there, but nobody's actually able to pin it because most of the research dollars that I'm seeing go look for genetic causes and not necessarily environmental causes.
It's, you had brought up the vaccine, and when my daughter was born 6 years ago, we decided not to do the vaccine, and really kind of got an earful from a lot of social friends, and a lot of the media really pumps for it. But it was my understanding that there was really no true research that correlated getting the vaccine and autism. Is that correct?
There, you know, it when you talk about research or you talk about individual cases. And I see individuals, and you have a parent who has a child who has vaccines but doesn't notice anything at all around the time the vaccine is given. The child's doing just fine but subsequently gets diagnosed with autism. And then you have parents who tell you, you know, we got our vaccines on one day and the next day our baby changed. Or that night, the baby was screaming up all night. Wow. So we have to look at individuals. You know, it just makes sense that if you had 100 children in your room and you gave them all a penicillin shot, somebody's probably not going to do well with penicillin, okay? So if you're giving the world's children hepatitis B vaccines or the DPTs or whatever, eventually you're going to find somebody who didn't do well with that. But it can be a combination of different issues, like we've been saying, but you have to talk about it individually. If you wanted to look at whether vaccines truly were causing a problem, you'd have to look at, say, the autism rates among those who've been vaccinated and compare that to the autism rates to those who've not been vaccinated. And I haven't seen those studies come out.
Yeah, and it sounds like that's what, you know, when you were talking about the fact of research and that they haven't done enough research, that would have been a great statistic, you know, for everybody to have before they make decisions in regards to various vaccinations. Now, we were going through your background, and we noticed that you were in med school in the 80s. Mm-hmm. You know, what was the difference then in regards to what we knew about autism as opposed to what it is that we know now?
Well, the published autism rates back in the 80s were somewhere between 1 to 4 children in 10,000.
Wow.
Okay. And now, you know, they're talking about 1 in 63 are going to be diagnosed with autism this year, of kids in the 2 to 3 to 4 range. So we do know that the numbers have increased dramatically. In my residency, I saw one child with autism, and they said, oh, Dr. Carcinelle, come look at this guy. You'll never see an autistic kid again. They're so rare. And now, of course, that's all I see day in and day out. So we do know the numbers have escalated dramatically.
You know, growing up, obviously, in that same era, the awareness of autism, you know, I think about family friends, and I basically could look at every single kid who was watching Star Trek in our social circle that was isolated and would have probably met the criteria. And so now we're sitting with a growing issue, a diagnosis that is affecting millions and millions of families across the United States and the world. And is our focus, should it be on early diagnosis? Because I'm looking at preventative measures, and aside from diet with parents, it seems as though our focus might be best fit on early diagnosis versus prevention. Is that accurate? Or,
well, in a way, yes. I mean, early diagnosis, again, even if you are able to diagnose it early, what are you going to want to do?
Right.
Treat it, make it stop, go away. Okay. So irrespective of if you diagnose this at 2 or 3, the parent just wants the screaming to stop, the self-injurious behaviors to stop, the biting to stop, being up all night to stop, whatever they come to me for in the clinic. So a diagnosis is fine. Our problem is that our professionals that I keep finding from what parents tell me about, say, pediatricians, they're not making the diagnosis. The hairdresser makes the diagnosis, or the daycare lady, or the mother-in-law, some nice lady at the park, and says, hey, do you know your child has autism? But the parent goes to the pediatrician and says, you know, I'm really got concerns about my boy. He's not speaking yet. Oh, boys don't speak. You know, it's okay. Well, he had language, but he lost it. Boys will do that. But he also has these weird flapping behaviors or whatever. Well, they go through a period where they just flap, and they kind of explain away. And each one of these issues is not a big thing. But when you start putting them all together about not sleeping, not being very self-selective with their eating, they're only eating one or two things. That's how I make the diagnosis. I just look at the constellation of symptoms, not just one or two.
Now, Jerry, one of the things that we're very proud of with this show is that our audience is very targeted. They get a chance to choose to listen to it, which means there's a good chance that we have parents who are thinking about that same thing in regards to diagnosis. So for a parent who has either just been given this diagnosis or thinks that maybe their child has this diagnosis, what would you advise them to do right now?
Wow, it's not the thing, it's the things. First of all, they should get involved in a group that has gone down this road already, because it's pretty traumatic to find out that your child has autism, which is a severe developmental disability, both in communication and social aspects, and the stereotypy, the flapping, the obsessive compulsive behaviors, the abnormal eating. I mean, these kids are very, very challenging in so many different directions. Even bathing can be a huge problem for these kids, and getting them dressed and stuff. So they need to find a support group. And I like Generation Rescue, Talk About Curing Autism. These are great support groups where they have these mommy angels who come alongside, whether it be the internet, a phone call, and basically tell the family, you know, here's what we've seen help children like yours. But getting out of the river of denial that he'll just outgrow it, that's real important. The next thing that seems to work with 80% of the families that I work with is removing dairy containing foods and gluten containing foods. And there's enough data on that to support that next decision that the family has to make, because that is a big deal. Now, changing the diet, especially when they're very limited, and right away they'll see some changes. Now, once that happens and they see some changes, then they can kind of sit there and say, hey, whatever you want to call this autism thing, we can modify its look by just changing diet. Maybe there are other treatments that we can do, other interventions we can do, so we can maybe minimize or even erase this silly diagnosis, which is just so traumatic.
Are we conceptualizing autism as a chronic illness? And the reason I ask is, with chronic illness, we look to treat the symptoms versus the underlying cure. Is that how are we kind of focusing? Is our focus on autism as a chronic illness, and it's to treat the symptoms versus the, quote, cure?
You're absolutely right. I think it's better to look at the symptoms that the child presents with and go after them. And, you know, that's where I used to get in trouble a decade and a half ago when we were treating autism, trying to cure autism. Glad you brought that up. Where the high-functioning folks would say, will you stop treating autism as a disease? We're just fine the way we are. And I'm going, wow, I'm very sorry. But if you broke your arm, would it be okay if I were to set it and put it in a cast? And they say, well, yeah. I said, well, that's what I'm basically doing. I'm finding what's broken with these kids. And if you fix them, then they're able to relate to their peers in a more normal, neurotypical fashion. So if you have a child, like, for example, I had an 18-month-old, a year-and-a-half-old baby come to me on Prozac. I've never seen an 18-month-old on Prozac. This was a vicious, vicious child mom and grandma came in and they were scratched up and bruised up, and you could see bite marks in their arms. This was a vicious kid. And I got an x-ray of his tummy, and he was full of stool. I mean, really impacted. Once we disimpacted him, he was the sweetest guy, and he can come off the Prozac. Did I cure the autism? No, but I cured the stuff that was making him violent and aggressive, and where some psychiatrist somewhere thought that he would benefit from Prozac. Well, Prozac, last time I looked, doesn't treat constipation. So if you start looking at these kids individually and see the symptom clusters, not sleeping at night, abdominal pain, frequent ear infections. You know, a lot of the kids come to me with a history of maybe 12 or 15 different antibiotic exposures for recurrent sinus infection or ear infection. Well, wouldn't it behoove me to test their stool, their urine for yeast? And if they've got yeast, we treat it. And if we treat the yeast infection, the kid gets better and starts becoming verbal. Did I fix his autism? No. But now he's able to be autistic and sleep the whole night and communicate with us. Well, how cool is that? The kids come and they have a lot of vitamin nutritional deficiencies because they have a very strange self-selective diet, usually carbohydrates and sugars. And, you know, if you don't take vitamin C in the form of citrus or supplementation, you run the risk of getting scurvy. And I was talking to an endocrinologist once who kind of looked at what I was doing, was kind of interested, kind of not. And the next time I saw him, he was so excited to tell me that he made his first diagnosis of scurvy in an autistic child. I said, well, he said, I heard what you told me. The child presented with multiple findings that were consistent with scurvy, and the kid had never had any vitamin C from the get-go. So that's what we're dealing with, and that's how we can make them a whole lot better. So they can. What we want to do is, and you brought up a good point, I started the conversation as there's a spectrum of disease from very low functioning to very high functioning, but somewhere in between those two is a block wall that I call functional. And I have children who are dysfunctional in our society, and I want to push them over into the functional. They can still be quirky, and I always kid like their daddies. They can be quirky, but functional is what I'm looking for. Are they cured? No, but they're functional, and I like functional. Functional goes to school. And functional learns and grows, and functional is able to interact with people. That's okay. So that's what I'm going after.
It's almost like we have this, and I look at a lot of mental health stuff on a continuum. And when you say functional, I think of drawing a line on that continuum to, you know, like you said, being able to go to school, being able to hold a job, being able to participate in, you know, quality relationships. And it's I guess it's our job in our professions to be able to get the people to that point.
Exactly.
Yeah, and you know, I keep going back to in my mind this concept of having gone from 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 64. Are there any surveys, or is there any testing that has been done to in other countries or other places where there's a different diet to see if we have caused this through the change of diet that we've had in the last, you know, 40 years?
Well, that's a good point, and I'm smiling right now just thinking about that. I have families who come in to see me. I've been very blessed, and I have families flying from all over the world, from Saudi Arabia and Argentina and Brazil and, of course, Canada, Mexico and Australia and the Middle East. And so I have varying geographies, varying socioeconomic classes. I have people with different foods from they come in vegetarians from, you know, different countries and stuff. So I can't really pin it on a geographical location. It's not everybody in the Midwest or near a coal plant or near a mine that operates, you know, getting lead out. Certainly there are kids who come from these different areas like Jakarta, Indonesia, who have a lot of lead exposure, or Northern Africa that have a lot of mercury exposure from gold processing. So there's heavy metal areas, but I haven't been able to see from a food point of view that I could say it's one type of food, or but because I have kids who come from pristine islands, you know, where the air is super clean and everything, and they're just as autistic as the kids who are in the Midwest.
So what I hear you saying really is there's no, you know, we have to sit with the fact that there's no crystal clear answer here, but we have made headwaves and we do have answers. It's just not as simple as 1 + 1 = 2.
No, not in this business, unfortunately. You guys know that.
Yeah. You know what? We're going to take a break, but please stay with us. And for everybody out there, we will be right back in 1 minute. Stay with us. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
Welcome back to Answers for the Family. We are joined with our guest here, Dr. Jerry Cartzenal. And for the listeners out there that don't know your background, I know there's a personal connection which led you into the field of autism. Do you mind sharing a little about that?
Sure. I was doing general pediatrics for about 10 years, and our fourth boy came along, and he developed autism roughly around 14, 15 months of age, and my wife basically told me to fix him. This was a little boy who was screaming all the time and was only eating five foods, French fries, Chips Ahoy, cookies, Fruit Loops, bacon, and a gallon of milk every day, and having diarrhea that would look like a child with cystic fibrosis, real sandy, and up all night, and just a terror. I mean, he just lived to destroy things and just was so sad and so miserable and so painful. He was just full of pain. And so I embarked on a journey on what's going on with these children that's so darn different. And how can we change things so that they can feel good? I mean, you could have autism, but you might as well feel good as opposed to having autism and feel miserable, painful inside.
And Jerry, you said that at about 15 months, he developed autism. So my question is that something that someone develops at that age, or is it something that they had at birth and is just discovered or diagnosed at that age?
Well, I think it's a little combination of all the things that you've just mentioned. For example, my wife was born allergic to penicillin, but she's just fine until you gave her a penicillin shot. So there's a genetic undermining, if you will, a genetic flaw, though my wife doesn't have any flaws, but if we had a look at one.
Jerry, you're a smart man.
Yeah.
But the penicillin got unmasked one time when she had a strep throat, and they gave her a penicillin injection in the doctor's office, and she went into anaphylaxis at that point. So I think these children are born with some sensitivities that they're just fine unless something comes along and unmasks that sensitivity. And I think that's why you have a lot of people concerned about, like you're saying, things in the environment, cell phones, vaccines, whatever, and is something unmasking these genetic predispositions that would never have had a problem had that thing or things, combination of things, changed them.
Similar to you and your wife, at a young age, you know, close to two, we have a listener question who has a child or a grandson the same age. And I want to read you the listener question, but I also want to take the time out to thank our listeners for calling in, for writing in. We really appreciate it. And hopefully, you know, Dr. Jerry, you can help them. The listener is Renee from New Jersey, and Renee wrote, "Autism statistics are frightening young parents. My grandson, who is two, has been diagnosed with the disorder, and although my daughter would love to have a second child, she and her husband just cannot fathom doing this given how this has affected their lives. What would you tell young parents who are facing the same situation of an early diagnosis of autism? Also, I am purchasing your book in the hopes it will be of help to them. Renee.
Well, Renee, that's really a tough decision for families to make, even my own son. David, he's my first boy, and David said, you know, we love Joshua very much, his youngest brother, but he and his wife were kind of nervous about having a baby because as much as they love Josh, you're right, they don't want one. Okay, I mean, the young couple, you know, especially if they've lived with an autistic individual, certainly that's not in their game plan. So it is a tough decision. I think you have to do a lot of reading. I think you have to look at what's been printed out there with respect to exposures when you're pregnant, you know, what kind of cleaning agents you're using. You want to get your body as clean as possible. You might want to look at your vitamin D levels. You may not want to get so many ultrasounds. You know, there was some... I have an ultrasound. None of my boys, and David is my oldest, he's going to be 30, none of my boys got ultrasounded when they were in the womb because I was worried about the sound waves, you know. So there was one study out of China that said ultrasounds might actually be a source of autism in some children. And then a new study that just came out a couple weeks ago from the University of Washington saying that ultrasounds may be affecting children's brains. So doing less when you're pregnant, you know, I'm always concerned about what the mom is ingesting during pregnancy. It's a very sacred time, and you know, you want to avoid caffeine, and you certainly want to not drink alcohol. You want to make sure your vitamin D levels are up. You don't want to be exposing your body to, say, bleach when you're cleaning out the shower stall or whatever. And then you may want to consider what's being asked to be injected into your body when you're 28 weeks along, whether it be the MMR vaccine or the DPT or the flu shot or whatever it is. And you might want to keep that body of yours kind of pristine. I mean, that's a sacred time between a mom and her developing baby. So read the books, read what people say about the certain current causation or correlation or temporal association. These are all fancy words for trying to skirt the issue, whether vaccines might be causing these issues or whether it be environmental, but try and limit as many exposures as possible.
You know, one of the critical things I heard you say from an earlier question is support. And as I think of Renee and I think of these young couples, the idea of having a nice network to support each other, you had mentioned it. Is this something that is actively out there in the community to find support groups?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Every area, because I get to take care of families from all over, and they'll say, well, where do I find, you know, gluten-free foods in Broken Bow, Oklahoma? And I was like, I don't know. But let's find some mommies out there who've already done this for you and see where you can find these foods. So I know Generation Rescue is very involved in supporting and helping, coming alongside moms and dads and educating them, and even getting them free supplements to try. And it's just a great organization that will provide a lot of support for families.
You know, Jerry, there's been a lot of publicity in regards to marijuana as something that is helping people in a variety of different ways. And I know that I've seen some videos of young children who have been given that have epilepsy, for instance, that have been given the tincture, the marijuana oil, and mm-hmm. it's taken them down from like 2,000 seizures a week to 3. What's your thought or knowledge of marijuana being something that is beneficial in these situations?
It's profound when it works. And we just have to be kind of careful when we look at isolated cases like that, epilepsy and marijuana. I have kids who do a lot of seizing. 30% of my practice has epilepsy and autism. Go figure. And they're on a lot of drugs, and the drugs don't work. And that's why parents were looking for an alternative, because they've been on the Depakote and Lamictal and Keppra and valproic acid and all this stuff. And it's not working for their particular child. So they're looking. I joke in my clinic that one of my best, now you guys have to understand, this is a joke, one of my best anti-seizure medications is Miralax. And you say, what? Constipation makes whatever you do for a living in my autism world 10 times worse. So if you're aggressive and you're backed up with stool, you're going to be really aggressive. If you have epilepsy and you're backed up with stool, you're going to have more epileptic seizure breakthroughs. Wow. So what I'm trying to say is it's not just as simple, and we'll get back to the marijuana question, it's not just as simple as, well, why don't we just throw some medical marijuana? You increase the chances of anything that we do, including medical marijuana, if you make your child as healthy as all as possible. You know, sleep deprivation lowers your seizure threshold. I have a lot of kids who aren't sleeping. So you want to make sure that the child is sleeping. How do you get a child to sleep? Well, you might have to change the diet. You might have to give them melatonin, or you might have to give them some other things that we use to help them sleep through the night. Because if you don't sleep, you're going to have a lot of seizures. So diet can help things, constipation, melatonin, but there's a big list of things. Now, getting to the actual, if we're going to use medical marijuana in one form or another for epilepsy, or I thought you were going to say anxiety and obsessive compulsive behaviors, it's amazing for anxiety. I had a kid who came to me once, and he was violent, and he was in chains. He had this special wheelchair where he had shackles on his legs and his feet, and he had a helmet on because somehow he'd be able to get his head down to his knee so he can do what we call self-injurious behavior and slam his head with it. And the psychiatrists failed and neurologists failed, and we put him on medical marijuana. This was in California, so it was legal. And the kid did amazingly well and is no longer shackled in a wheelchair or wearing that helmet, okay? So my bottom line is it can be a very effective intervention for a lot of things besides just epilepsy. But I think its biggest uses are epilepsy and anxiety.
You know, and the other side of looking at something like marijuana is when we're looking at other childhood disorders such as ADHD, and you've got undiagnosed ADHD, these kids seem to be in a higher risk for actually using it as a self-medication, not as, you know, through a medical provider. In TV shows, you know, there's a new popular TV show, iRobot, where the lead character, I believe, has autism. And he self-medicates with opiates. Are you seeing undiagnosed autism adolescents at a very high risk for self-medication with drugs?
Well, you said autism, but you start out with ADD. An autistic child who's dysfunctional isn't obviously going to be able to go to a dispensary and start self-medicating. But those kids who are high-functioning, you know, we've been self-medicating for millennia. I mean, when you think about it, the coffee that I drank this morning, and I actually have a cup right now, the caffeine stimulates the cells in my brain that make dopamine, and the dopamine comes to the front part of my brain and helps me have focus and concentration. So I'm self-medicating with a cup of coffee. Nicotine stimulates nicotinic receptor sites. So you'll still see people who drink coffee and smoke cigarettes so they can have focus and concentration. Alcohol stimulates the GABAergic receptor sites in the brain and can bring along, you know, take away anxiety and help you feel better. So I think we have, as human beings, a long history of self-medicating. But I think you're absolutely right. I think a lot of teens with ADD will get into medications, self-medicating, so their brains calm down and feel like, well, maybe like yours and I do on an everyday basis.
Yeah, you know, we've noticed just by watching television and through social media, they tend to say that Jenny McCarthy's son doesn't have autism anymore. What is your thoughts on that? Is it something that you're aware of, and what do you see in that?
But I think, first of all, because there have been patients of mine in the past, I probably shouldn't comment on that particular aspect. What I can say is that, remember that line in between functional and dysfunctional. And if we were able to successfully push any child onto the functional side, and they do have social skills, and they aren't hyper-focused, and they aren't stimming anymore, they are not going to meet the criteria of autism. It doesn't mean that they're not going to have particular challenges with focus or anxiety or maybe some obsessive-compulsive natures, But what it does mean is they're functional and they're not dysfunctional, and they wouldn't currently meet the standard of the autism diagnosis. I think that's pretty cool.
So moving forward, what are we looking at as a society and in the medical field? Do we have a positive outlook on the future of autism treatment, and what's next for it?
Well, I'm still disappointed in how the American Academy of Pediatrics is not moving or making any progress toward helping us physicians manage and treat our patients with autism. Very, very little is written. More is written about how to make a diagnosis and how to refer them off, but they're still not talking about interventions that we know are good, unless they come from a pharmaceutical. So you'll see that Risperdal is still being touted as one of the FDA-approved indications for autism and stuff. So we're not getting any movement from the medical schools. Where I have a clinic in California, and I'm a stone's throw away from UCLA and USC and UC Irvine and Loma Linda, and to the south is UC San Diego, and the north is the Mind Institute at UC Davis, UC San Francisco. Nothing is coming out, even talking about something like constipation or sleep issues in children with autism and what the pediatrician can do about it to make these families' lives so much better. So I think medicine is still stuck in the neutral mode as far as being innovators on how to manage these children. So it's going to be up to some of the more maverick docs who want to go out there and make a difference in these children's lives and their families' lives. So I'm still a little bit dismayed by the ignorance and the just the willful, I'm not looking at this problem kind of picture, and it's affecting so many kids, and they're just, nothing's coming out.
Now, Jerry, I read something recently that said that our government has spent in excess of $1 billion to fight the Zika virus, which I don't know how much, I think we've had 4 cases or something in the United States. One of the things that that we do as investigators is we say, follow the money. If you follow the money, you will generally find your answer. What is it that we can do to help direct the money so that it goes where it needs to go? Because as I'm listening to you, what I'm hearing is that, these schools are not getting funding that is sent into them to do the research necessary for this. But if we've gone from 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 64, to me, this has got to be a much bigger issue than if we get the Zika virus into this country.
You're right on there. And when you think about that 1 in 64 number, half those are girls, right? Half girls, half boys. Mm-hmm. And girls generally don't get autism. It's about a 1 in 5. So you're talking about 1 in 35 males being born this year, in about 2 to 3 years will have the diagnosis of autism.
Wow.
1 in 35, because the girls are diluting the number. Well, they always say that girls rule and boys drool. Girls have a stronger immune system. For whatever reason, they seem to be a little bit more protected. They talk about testosterone maybe making us a little bit weaker, more susceptible to environmental insults. But again, this is all theoretical. It's not been proven. But irrespective of that, I think that our politicians know that there are concerns about vaccines. There are concerns about environmental toxicants that are entering our bodies. But you're seeing nothing happening. And I for the life of me, as you guys can sit there and agree, it's like, why would we be worried about 4 cases of this or bring in 1 case of Ebola or whatever when we've got so many children who are just falling apart at the seams due to autism and just... the psychological stress of autism in a family is just amazing. I mean, socially, your friends disappear. Nobody wants to come over to your house. You don't want to bring your kid to anybody's house. You don't go to church anymore or your synagogue because they're not set up for taking care of this kid, so you're being isolated. Financially, it's devastating for you. Somebody has to stay home with the child. And it's just the tolls on each family is just amazing. And like you said, there's not much being done. I don't know what else we can do.
Well, I think one of the things that we can do is for the professionals out there, for the parents out there, think about before you make your next vote at whatever level, at the local level and higher up, find out how many of them have huge donations being made from medical organizations or whatever. And if they do, explain to them that if they don't start taking care of the things that are most important to you, that they're not going to be voted in.
Well, we've always said that if any of the politicians wants to, whether they mean it or not, and hopefully they do, put this on their agenda as one of the things that they're going to tackle and make sure there's going to be plenty of funding for. Because this affects so many families, I heard now that autism affects in one way or another one in four individuals.
Wow.
That they're a shoe-in for this. But, you know, I think what everybody's afraid of is this darn tag of vaccines and the pharmaceutical source of autism that nobody wants to touch. It's like the third rail in politics. You just don't want to touch it because if you start looking too closely, you might not like what you see, and therefore it would be not a good thing to be involved with. And I think that's what is blocking anybody from being publicly involved in taking care of these issues because they're worried about the V word, the vaccines.
So we've got only a very short amount of time to pick your brain today, but I know our listeners are very interested and excited to learn more. Aside from Healing and Preventing Autism, a complete guide, and visiting your website at drjerryk.com, how else can people reach you, get a hold of you, and pick your brain and learn from you?
Well, you know, I'm doing a conference, or I'm part of a conference at Generation Rescue in beautiful Dallas in September, and it's the Autism Education Network. And if they just look at the Autism Education Network in on Google, or Autism Education Summit, not Network, Summit, they can see what we're doing there. I think the best thing that our families can do is get educated, find a physician who's literate in taking care of autism and go from there. But education with Dr. Google, there's so much to be had out there. It's too much. But getting involved with people who've been down the road, I think, is the best thing. They can find their favorite books. And not every book is perfect. I mean, not mine, not anybody's. But it'll start giving you hope and insight that there are interventions that can bring about meaningful changes in your child. I mean, just the hope that a family can have a child who sleeps through the night, or a child who can have language, who can answer questions, yes or no, or tell you what they want. I mean, those are just baby steps, but pretty darn amazing when you don't have any of that. A child who can be potty trained. You know, you're not going to be taking care of a child in diapers when he's 16. I mean, there's some really wonderful things that we can do.
Well, Jerry, I think you've already been doing a lot of wonderful things in your research, in putting out your book. I realize that you got into this, you know, this particular area when it in regards to one of your own children, but taking that and now making a difference for everyone out there, we just want to take this time to acknowledge you and thank you for what you've done.
Well, thank you, and appreciate you taking the time to take on this this very controversial subject and bringing it out to the families who are listening that that there is hope and there is some things that we can do to bring some meaningful changes in the lives of families who have a child with, or two or three, with autism.
Well, Matt and I certainly are not afraid of a little controversy. So again, for everybody out there, thank you so much for listening. Again, I think that you know, if you have the opportunity, pick up Jerry's book, you know, because you know, it can help all of us. And even if you don't have somebody in your family right now, that knowledge could be something that could benefit you or your family members in the future.
And please be sure to put us on your calendar and tune in next Monday, September 26th, when our guest Jackie Parker will discuss transforming relationships, using meditation and writing as a vehicle for healing, well-being, and community. And if you missed or you want to share our show with your friends, please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com. You may also subscribe or resubmit your name to download your free copy of Attitude of Gratitude Journal, your 21-day guide to achieving the quality of thankfulness through self-discovery. And the next time you're on Facebook and Twitter, please remember to stop by our page, check out some of our latest posts, and if you like them, please like us and spread the word.
And be good humans and be with us again next week for Answers for the Family.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.